politics of love essential to our survival?
Underneath every problem is the proverbial man's inhumanity to man. Every problem, if you go to its core, is our lack of reverence and love for ourselves, for each other, for animals, and for the planet itself. If you are dissociated from any sense of ethical or moral responsibility to life around you, first of all, that irreverence is itself insane.
That's activist, spiritual leader, and former presidential candidate Marianne Williamson. We talk with her about her book, A Politics of Love, a handbook for a new American revolution. Then we replay an extended excerpt from our 2020 interview with Rabbi Michael Lerner about his book, Revolutionary Love. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. And hey, you know you can go to writersvoice.net to find extra content with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I've often said that we could solve everything if we all just followed the golden rule: treat others as you would be treated. In other words, love thy neighbor as thyself. And we're all neighbors on this finite planet. When Marianne Williamson ran in the 2020 presidential election, she was mocked by mainstream pundits for her supposedly naive message of a politics of love. But as she brilliantly argues in her book of that title, what's naive is to think that we can survive the crises we face without love at the core of our politics. Letting a tiny cabal of corporate criminals destroy all of creation for their short-term profit, is that really practical? Or is it naive to the point of insanity? Slashing social benefits for millions of Americans just because you don't want people with darker skin to have nice things? Is that practical or just plain stupid? When we hurt others, we hurt ourselves. When we treat others with love and compassion, we uplift us all. That's as true in politics as it is in our individual lives. And as a politics of love shows with its powerful narrative, we have no choice but love if we are to survive. Marianne Williamson is an internationally acclaimed author, speaker, and activist, as well as former presidential candidate. Six of her published books have been New York Times bestsellers. A Politics of Love was published in 2019. Well, Marianne Williamson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
You know, this book, A Politics of Love, it's a couple of years old, but it's certainly worn well. It's just as relevant as it is when it was first came out in, I believe, 2019. You begin A Politics of Love by going back to the 1980s, during the era when AIDS was killing so many people, especially in the gay community. And you say that that era was a deep initiation for you and many others who came together at that time. An initiation into what?
Well, first of all, it was like living in a war zone, as everyone can remember who was part of that field, whether you were trying to help people or whether you were yourself dealing with the ravages of the disease. Not only people who had virus, but people whose sons had contracted it, or brothers or sisters or parents. I mean, there was so much suffering. And at the same time, it was such a full tilt catastrophe. And we live in a very privileged society. Very few people who lived through that had ever, myself included, by the way, had ever experienced something that was, number one, so awful, and number two, that the institutions we normally counted on could not help us. In this case, the you know, allopathic Western medical community. Now, they weren't trying. They were trying very hard. But it took time before they came up with anything that wasn't just, you know, an empty gas tank. That was the horror of AIDS, of course, was that there was no cure. There was, for a long time, no way to manage it. I remember we were hoping and talking about AIDS becoming a chronic manageable condition, the way cancer is in many cases today. So at that time, it was such a deep horror. But what I talked about in that chapter that you referred to is, in the midst of that horror, we had nothing to do except hold on to one another. I was in Los Angeles, but also in New York at the time, working as an AIDS activist. And both of those cities can look back with pride at how the communities as a whole showed up for a very ravaged population. A large part of that had to do with the fact that, of course, New York is the center of Broadway theater. LA is the center of Hollywood and the entertainment industry. And the gay population in both cases is contributive beyond their numbers. So in both cases, there was such a ravaging of creative communities, whether it was to do with photographers or cinematographers or writers or actors. There was such loss, but there was also such compassion. And I think that those who went through that experience, participated in one way or the other, were marked by something. And when you meet people who went through sort of the same war you went through, you know, we're veterans of the same war. And it's a bit of a mark on your forehead. And that's what I mean by saying it was an initiation. I think that it's relevant, and this is why I talked about it in the book, because I think we're living at a time in America where, once again, we are faced with a collective full-tilt catastrophe. And I think that with AIDS, you couldn't pretend that it was otherwise. I think when it comes to our political situation in the United States, it's only now that people are awakening to the fact that this cannot be denied. We're in trouble. This is a very troublesome chapter of American history. And I think we're being called upon to respond to it with the same level of dedication and reverence and conviction with which so many people responded to the AIDS crisis.
Yeah, you know, you of course are known as a spiritual leader. You started your spiritual journey with A Course in Miracles, which I know I remember it at the time. I was a little repelled by the Christian thinking in it because I'm Jewish, and I know you are too. My mother, however, was really into it. My problem with it was that I felt it was based on magical thinking that ignored the social realities of power and oppression. Yet this book, A Politics of Love, is very much about social realities. So talk about that divide that so many people see between spiritual concerns versus political action and how you connect them.
Well, first of all, I understand what you were saying about the Christian language. When I first saw The Course in Miracles, I first opened it, I saw the Christian language. And even though I had studied comparative religion in college, this was not school. So I turned it down I closed the book for that reason. A year later, when I opened it and began reading it, I saw this is not the Christian religion. It is not a religion at all. It is a psychological mind training. And that while it does use some of the traditional Christian terms, these terms are being used in very psychotherapeutically oriented psychological ways. Similarly, I think if you actually read the book, if you actually read into the book, you would not see it as magical thinking at all. You would see it as an explanation of how consciousness operates. And whether it's a political issue or an economic issue, you can trace all issues back to human consciousness and the role that human consciousness played in the creation of that issue. So if anything, A Course in Miracles has only deepened not only my political commitment, which was always there actually, but it has deepened my sense of the solutions that are possible within the political and economic realm. So I think I'm very sensitive myself to magical thinking. The Course in Miracles is not a book of magical thinking.
Well, you got me there because I didn't read into it. So I have to admit that. And that's a good explanation. I'd actually like to ask you a little bit more then about this, how consciousness creates these issues or these problems. Make the connection now to the politics of this book, A Politics of Love.
The Course in Miracles says that there is no such thing as a neutral thought. All thought creates form on some level. When Gandhi was asked, what's the biggest problem in the world? He responded that the biggest problem in the world is that humanity is not in its right mind. Underneath every problem is the proverbial man's inhumanity to man. Every problem, if you go to its core, is our lack of reverence, devotion, and love for ourselves, for each other, for animals, and for the planet itself. If you are dissociated from any sense of ethical or moral responsibility to life around you, first of all, that irreverence is itself insane. And then you are vulnerable to such things as economic systems that are completely divorced from ethical responsibility. You are vulnerable to political systems that are divorced from any sense of compassion or mercy or justice. And you are vulnerable to the propaganda that lures you into those things because you are not aligned with the kind of thinking that simply lifts you above all those illusions, because you know that which is not love becomes suspicious at best and vicious at worst. You know, this is kind of interesting because some people who project onto such studies as higher consciousness would say about people like myself that we're naive. I think it's the opposite. I think people who think only in terms of the symptoms and only in terms of eradicating and suppressing symptoms of social, political, and economic malaise, they are naive. They are naive to think that traditional mechanistic thinking, allopathic thinking, which only addresses symptom, is going to hold back the wave of horror that is now upon us. They're the naive ones. What's naive is to think that we are going to continue as a species on this planet for another 100 years if we do not fundamentally and radically change our ways.
Yeah, and that's what you call radical love, radical in the sense of going to the root. You know, one of the threads in this book is that you point to both what is, both the problems that we have, as well as the promise that we have as a society and have had from the beginning, both things. You point to the contradictory strains in the American psyche and history, equality and justice for all on the one hand versus slavery on the other. It's a pretty radical contradiction. Some people would say American democracy is a sham and always has been. How do you answer them? How do you see that more positive strain in our history is something real that can be nurtured?
We have always been both and. That's baked into the cake. You had 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence who were, by signing that document, infusing the most enlightened principles that had ever formed the core of a nation into our national mission statement. But 41 out of those 56 signers were slave owners. So that struggle, that dichotomy, that almost bipolar aspect of the American mind was there from the beginning. It's in our national DNA. And every generation lives out the struggle. On one hand, those of us who are excited by those principles, who are willing to struggle for those principles, who in many cases have sacrificed even unto their lives for those principles, that has been a factor in every generation. But there has also been a factor in every generation of people who, usually for their own economic purposes, right, have no intention of seeing those principles universally applied or actualized, and have proven, sometimes in the most violent ways, that they will do what it takes to stop it. That is as true of America today as it has ever been. And in my mind, you know, every generation writes a chapter in this book, this continuing book, and every generation lives out that struggle. But if you look at the whole arc of our history, okay, we have tended to self-correct. We answered slavery with abolition. We answered the institutionalized suppression of women with the women's suffragette movement. We answered segregation with the civil rights movement. So I think that people who only want to look at what's wrong in our history and will give no credence to what we have done right are as unbalanced in their analysis as are people who only want to talk about what we've done right and have no listening for what we have done wrong. Yes, we need to identify the problems in our past, but I think I need to identify with the problem solvers. So people who say American democracy has been a scam for the whole time, you know what? That's such intellectual laziness to even say that, because it is simply not true. There are people who have expanded the democratic franchise, and sometimes even at the expense of their lives.
Hmm. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with activist, spiritual leader, and former presidential candidate Marianne Williamson about her book, A Politics of Love, A Handbook for a New American Revolution. You also talk about karma. I mean, you believe in karma. I've often thought that slavery is our original sin, and that the karma that we are living out is very much rooted to our practice of slavery. You were the only presidential candidate who called for reparations. You still call for a reparations council. Talk about karma, the spiritual underpinning, I guess, of the call for reparations.
Karma simply means the law of cause and effect. The law of cause and effect simply is. Really, your opinion is irrelevant. You know what I'm saying? Every action has a reaction. And that is not only true on the material level, it's also true on the psychological level. You cannot have the future you want if you do not clean up your past. So in Catholicism, they have confession. In Judaism, the most holy day of the year is Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. In Alcoholics Anonymous, 12-step programs are a program of amends where you have to admit the exact nature of your character defects and nature of your wrongs, atone for them, and seek to make amends. These are psychological and spiritual principles. All that a nation is a group of individuals. So the same psychological principles that dominate the experience of one life dominate the experience of a nation. So whether you're a person or a nation, you cannot have the future you want if you don't clean up the past, because the law of cause and effect means until you clean something up, it's still going to have an effect. Now, the way I see it, the Civil War was not nothing. The Voting Rights Act was not nothing. In fact, until the John Roberts Supreme Court gutted it, it was working quite fine, thank you. It was passed in the 1960s, and then they started gutting it in 2010. That's why we have all these voter suppression issues today. And the Civil Rights Act was not nothing. I believe that if Martin Luther King had lived, and particularly if we'd not had Richard Nixon as president, who was advised by Daniel Patrick Moynihan to practice what he called benign neglect in relation to the race issue, then we would have gotten to what I see as the third pillar of real racial reconciliation. And that would have been economic remuneration. At the end of the Civil War, General Tecumseh Sherman had promised to every formerly enslaved family of four 40 acres and a mule. In other words, if you've been kicking somebody to the ground, you owe it to do more than stop kicking. You owe it to them to help them get back up. If people have been enslaved, and for centuries, let's not kid ourselves, like 250 years, and then, of course, you have another 100 years of institutionalized suppression in the form of segregation. Well, let's just even go back to the end of slavery. People were told you're not enslaved anymore. But then what are they supposed to do? Where are they supposed to go? That 40 acres and a mule would have helped people get back up on their feet. I think a lot of people in America, I don't personally believe that we are a quote unquote racist people, but I think that there are millions and millions of Americans who are undereducated about the history of race in the United States, in some cases miseducated about the history of race in the United States. And I've seen so often with audiences that when you give them a 10-minute thumbnail sketch of the history of Black people in America from 1619 until now, reparation simply makes sense. You know, it is not, by the middle of the 20th century, it was not considered a fringe belief that a people that has wronged another people would provide economic restitution. You and I are both Jewish. Germany has paid $89 billion in reparations for the Holocaust. They have paid $89 billion to Jewish organizations. And you and I, I'm sure, are also aware that World War II ended in 1945. That process of reparations, I mean, obviously, it doesn't mean the Holocaust didn't happen. We can't make slavery not have happened. But I think that those reparations have gone far towards healing the relationship between Germany and the Jews of Europe. We, on the other hand, have been handing this toxic baton generation to generation ever since the end of the Civil War and before that. So I think that we can be the generation that makes a fundamental shift once again. Nothing is going to take care of every wound, but I believe that reparations is the kind of fundamental break with the past that would not only truly shift things on an economic level, but I believe on a psychological and emotional level as well. And that's where a lot of the toxicity dwells today.
Now, you know, the relative power of hate, it seems these days, as a political force, is swamping the relative power of love. You say that our goal now is not to defeat political opponents, but engagement in the art of moral persuasion, the ability to commune, so commune with the heart of another that real communication can occur. And yet, I feel like, how do we communicate with people who seem so hate-filled and so subject to conspiracy and delusion?
The problem on a pure electoral basis is not how many people would vote for Trump. The problem on a purely electoral basis is how many people would not vote. And how many people would not vote is due to the fact that our political system has not, in the words of Franklin Roosevelt, delivered on the promises of democracy. And the Democratic Party has as much to look in the mirror regarding that issue as the Republicans do. We've had the White House for 16 years. The fact that we still don't have universal health care when they have it, and Bill Clinton, I must say, they certainly tried. The Clintons certainly tried. Obamacare was, you know, as far as he would go, as far as the insurance companies would allow him to go. Every other advanced democracy, plus Russia and China at this point, plus Cuba, for God's sake, have universal health care. They have free college or very, very affordable college. And Americans look around and they go, what is this democracy thing I'm supposed to be so excited about? Literally, what has it done for me? And while the Republican Party has been dedicated to the corporate dominance of our government and our society, the Democrats, because of Citizens United, because of the corporate donors, because of the plutocrats who have donated, try to have it both ways. So the neoliberal corporatists who run the Democratic Party try to fix things on the periphery. They try to ameliorate people's suffering, but they too refuse to challenge the underlying forces, particularly corporate forces, that make all that suffering inevitable. So I believe in what Franklin Roosevelt said. He said, we do not have to worry about a fascist or a communist takeover as long as democracy delivers on its promises. Democracy has not delivered on its promises for the last 40 years. The last 40 years has simply seen a massive transfer of wealth into the hands of 1%, destroyed our middle class, and created almost a class of serfs. So at this point, once again, in agreement with Franklin Roosevelt, who said, just ameliorating the suffering of people is not enough. We need fundamental economic reform. I agree with him when he said, it has become clear to me, he said, that we must become fairly radical for a generation. That is what the New Deal represented, and that is what we need today.
And we're not there, as you say. I mean, the Democratic Party certainly has more people who believe that way than it used to, but they're being fought at every turn by the corporate Democrats, by the leadership of the Democratic Party. So what can people do if our party won't deliver and their party is fascist? How do we turn things around?
Well, this is the way I see it, Francesca. I think it's going to be like the Berlin Wall. So you ask, what made the Berlin Wall come down? Well, on a material level, somebody made a phone call and somebody else made a phone call. And it was weird miscommunication. And somebody thought they were supposed to open a gate and it opened up. Well, that's technically what made the wall fall, but not really. It fell because of so much pressure accumulating over so much time. So the way I see it is neoliberalism and its dominance, as you just described, of the Democratic as well as the Republican Party. It is based on a lie. And I say that because it is based on a system that has no mercy, has no compassion, has no love. It has no, in that sense, what Martin Luther King would call cosmic support and companionship. So how are we going to bring it down? Every time we have a podcast such as yours where we're talking about it, every time somebody runs, whether it's for a local office, for a school board, for a state or a federal position, every time somebody starts a labor union, every time somebody makes sure that their library is protected from book banning, it's not going to be any one thing. It's going to be inside and outside. It's going to be everybody taking an inch. Because remember, Francesca, the things that we're talking about here are majority opinions. We are now being ruled by a minority, and it creates the impression that that's where America is. But if you actually look at the polls, Americans are a little bit left of center. The vast majority of Americans want universal health care. Why wouldn't they? The vast majority of Americans want easy access to college and higher education and tech schools. The vast majority of Americans want a cleaner environment. The vast majority of Americans want an unrigged economic system. So I think that we have to think in terms of, did you take an inch today? Did you inconvenience somebody today that needed to be inconvenienced? Yours might have been a podcast. Somebody else might be a city council race. Somebody else might be a congressional primary. I think we all have to remember that there are millions of people, Francesca, having basically the same conversation that you and I are having all over this country. We have to remember that. I think too many times, you know, I have a friend who talks about these things and he always says, nobody's talking about this. Nobody's talking about this. And I always say to him, everybody I know is talking about this. I think sometimes we feel alone when we need not feel alone. We're all contributing to the larger conversation. And, you know, going back to the Course in Miracles, the Course in Miracles says an idea grows stronger when it is shared. And I just think there's more and more resonance, particularly now. I mean, if you look at COVID, what did Americans find out? Americans found out from COVID that unfettered, unregulated crony capitalism doesn't care if you drop dead. So anybody had any question about that, can't have any question now. Nothing, absolutely nothing, not even hundreds of thousands of people unnecessarily dying is enough to convince some people that maybe, just maybe, they would give in a little on their adherence to short-term profit at all costs. So I think a lot of people have woken up now and gone, you know, this has gone too far. And I think there's tremendous political and social potential in that. I think people are processing it, but I think there's a lot of movement. You know, it's like when a woman is pregnant. you know, there are 9 months during which that baby isn't here yet, but it's growing inside. And I think we become pregnant with ideas. We become pregnant with political movements. We become pregnant with new eras of history. We're pregnant in our consciousness. And I have faith in the American people. You know, Churchill said, you can always count on Americans to do the right thing after they've exhausted every other option. We are sometimes slow to get there. But when we do get there, we slam it like nobody's business. And we're going to. I don't know what it's going to be exactly. But just like if you look at what Christian Smalls did for the labor movement, there are all these people who have worked so hard. Sarah Nelson, Bernie's worked on it, Max Alvarez. But something about the Christian Smalls being able to do what they said couldn't be done. He was able to unionize that JFK 8 in Staten Island, $120,000 on a GoFundMe page, defeating the $4.3 million that Jeff Bezos spent. Something opens up a space and then people rush through. That's what's going to happen. Something's going to happen. I can't tell you what it's going to look like. I can't tell you when it's going to be, but there will be that moment. And, you know, I think, Francesca, things are so bad right now that something really good is possible. Because when things get really bad, it's like we were talking about with AIDS. James Baldwin said, not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing that is not faced can be changed. And people are facing some things now that are painful, but it's an awakening sometimes. And your heart cracks open and your mind cracks open and you go, oh, I get it. And when enough Americans get it, oh, baby, we're not nothing. And we have to remember what the abolitionists did, what the women's suffragettes did, what the civil rights workers did. Let's not be the first generation in American history to wimp out on doing what it takes to put this country back on track when we have so deeply swerved from our moral and ethical center.
Well, that is a beautiful place to end. Marianne Williamson, it's a wonderful book, really, A Politics of Love. I was a Bernie person, and he really had me when he talked about love as well. I think the two of you were the ones who understood how important love is to making the world that we all want to see. Thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you, Francesca. I so appreciate the opportunity.
Marianne Williamson. Read an excerpt from A Politics of Love at writersvoice.net by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, more on love and politics. This time with Rabbi Michael Lerner. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Back in 2020, we spoke with Rabbi Michael Lerner about his take on love and politics, his book, Revolutionary Love. It focuses on different points than Marianne Williamson's book, but is very much coming from the same place. Let's listen back to an extended segment from that conversation. We live in a country that's deeply divided politically. Many of us feel utterly hopeless, that the divide can ever be bridged. Yet it must if we are to deal with the crises we face, from COVID-19 to economic and racial inequality to the climate emergency. Rabbi Michael Lerner says the cause is the capitalist globalization of selfishness. In his book, Revolutionary Love, Lerner says we must replace selfishness with a globalization of generosity, of empathy, and environmental sanity. His strategy is for a new democratic socialism built on love, kindness, and compassion for one another. Rabbi Michael Lerner is the founder of Tikkun, an organization dedicated to the meaning of its name, to repair the world. Rabbi Michael Lerner, welcome to Writer's Voice. This book, as you say, it has a fundamentally simple message that rings with intuitive truth. This is a message, this book, Revolutionary Love, I think the message is really in the title, goes deeply to a kind of epiphany I had several years ago when I felt that if we are really going to protect our planet and create another world that's possible, that's just, and nourishes life, that we need to have a kind of moral revolution, a kind of revolutionary spiritual movement. And I felt at the time that nobody was talking about that. You know, everything was always in terms of, you know, economic justice, which was perfectly great. But underneath economic justice and environmental justice is fundamentally the idea that we all have to take care of each other. Is that right?
Absolutely. So I am a strong supporter of economic justice and political justice in this country. But I agree with you that underlying it, we need a new ethos in this country. And that's what this book, Revolutionary Love, is really all about. It's about how to develop that new ethos, that new way of thinking about our world. Unfortunately, we're up against a huge indoctrination that keeps on happening every day in the worlds of work and in the media. And that indoctrination is the ethos of selfishness, of looking out for number one, of believing that nobody else in the world is going to take care of you, so you've got to take care of yourself and put yourself above everybody else because there's no other way, because everybody else is doing that. And because everybody else is doing that, it seems impractical and even utopian to think that we could live in a different kind of society. And yet, what I try to do in Revolutionary Love is show that it's not only not utopian, it is actually the absolute necessity for being able to then turn to the serious problems of our society, the most serious one being the destruction of the environment, and deal with it in a serious and holistic way that isn't constrained by our sense of, well, it'll never happen. We can't really change the way that we organized our society. So let's keep going into the inevitable environmental disaster that we are facing today, of which the pandemic is merely first one of many plagues that will get worse and worse.
So you've been talking about revolutionary love in general terms. Could you get a little more specific?
First of all, about revolutionary love, it is the kind of love that is enjoined by the Bible. The Bible has, of course, that famous, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. But that appears once in the Torah. But about 37 other times, there's an injunction or varieties of the following. When you come into your land, do not oppress the stranger, the other. The Hebrew word is ger, and it means the other or the stranger. Remember that you are strangers in the land of Egypt. So we could say the same thing about the United States. Remember, your ancestors in this country were strangers here. They were the immigrants. They were the newcomers here. And we need a society that treats every newcomer and every person as equally valuable. So revolutionary love is about loving not just the people that you know, not just the next door neighbor. It is about looking on all human beings on this planet as deserving equally of well-being as you yourself. And that's a high bar, but it's a bar that actually many people already embody in parts of their life. When somebody says, oh, well, that's against human nature to risk anything for the sake of somebody else, I often point to the incredible reality of 9/11, in which after that horrendous attack on the towers, thousands of people came down to there and tried their best to save the lives of people. And that involved thousands of them going into those burning buildings and helping people get out of there. And hundreds of them actually died in that process. That is, they were willing to sacrifice, to risk the sacrifice, to risk their lives for the sake of others. That's revolutionary love, recognizing that we're all in this together and that the love of the other is precisely what will rebound to you and make your life better when you're living in a society where people are really caring for each other. So that's the central vision of revolutionary love. And it's one that requires us to reject the message of the capitalist marketplace with its notion that the rational way to live is to maximize your own good without regard to the well-being of others. That's the ethos of selfishness. And the United States is one of the most selfish countries on the planet. It has generated so much in the way of shutting our eyes to the suffering of others that we ourselves cause. In fact, not only to others in other countries, but in our own country, shutting our eyes to the suffering of the homeless, shutting our eyes to the suffering of those who are desperate to flee countries that have been oppressive to them or violent towards them and get refuge here. That's what the United States used to be in the old days, but we've moved far away from that today. So that's part of what it means to embrace revolutionary love. But more concretely, we suggest as a functional definition that we need a new bottom line. Today, every economic institution, our corporations, our government policies, our healthcare system, our educational system, our cultural systems, our legal systems, they're all based on the old bottom line that judges those institutions to be efficient, rational, and productive to the extent that they maximize money or power for somebody. Today, the new bottom line challenges that. And it says, we want every institution that I've just mentioned, including our legal system, including our political system, including our economy, including our cultural systems, including our educational systems, to be judged efficient, rational, and productive to the extent that they maximize people's capacity to be loving and caring, kind and generous, ethically and environmentally sensitive and responsible for protecting the earth, maximize our commitment to social and economic justice, and maximize our capacity to respond to other human beings as embodiments of the sacred, rather than seeing them solely through the framework of what can they do for me to advance my interests, and looking at the earth, not simply from the standpoint of, I wonder if there's something here I can turn into a product and sell, a commodity that I can sell in the marketplace and make a buck off the earth, but rather also looking at the earth from the standpoint of awe and wonder and radical amazement at the grandeur and mystery of this universe. That's the new bottom line. And if we can get that new bottom line adopted by more and more people, we will be a long way towards creating the caring society.
That's really beautifully put. And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Rabbi Michael Lerner about his wonderful new manifesto It's called Revolutionary Love. You know, you mentioned before that we have a selfish culture. And I think a lot of people, you know, you hear it a lot on the right, that there is an equation between being selfish and being free, having freedom. Yet you point out that there is a profound, what do you call it, the great deprivation here, a profound psychological as well as spiritual crisis in America. So does selfishness mean that we're free or quite the opposite?
Right. It certainly doesn't mean we're free. It means that we're tied to a very narrow definition of self-interest that ends up being deeply unsatisfying for most people in the country, and hence tremendous amount of pain in this country. So I'm not only a rabbi, but I'm also a psychologist. And I was the principal investigator of one of the largest studies ever funded by the NIMH with regard to the psychodynamics of work and family life. In that, as the principal investigator, and I had a bunch of associates working with me, we had groups and interviews with thousands of middle-income working people. And it took a while for people to reveal this, but in those groups, eventually, because you ask people how they're doing and they say fine, but that's because people want to be seen as successful and doing okay in the society. But when you stick around with them in groups for a little bit longer time, eventually you can give people the capacity to talk about what's really hurting them in their lives. And what we found was that almost everybody is carrying around a self-blaming story. Now, why a self-blaming story? Because they've grown up in a society which tells them that anybody can make it if you really try. And this is a meritocracy. And so wherever you end up in the society, you created your reality yourself, and you have nobody to blame but yourself. Of course, what this leaves out is the whole economic and political structures within which we live our lives. But the internalization of that message leads the top 10 to 15 to maybe even 20% of economic survivors, the ones who are at the top of the economic ladder, say, yeah, great. Yes, I did it. I made myself, I got here and I worked hard and so forth. But for the other 80% of the population, those of us who are making less than, let's say, $70,000 a year, for the other 80% of the population, this message is internalized as self-blaming. Oh, I have struggles financially. I'm scared about what's going to happen in my life because I don't have financial reserves, because I'm not in the upper groups. I have jobs that aren't really that fulfilling. I can't see the connection between what I'm doing and some higher purpose for my life. So I have nobody to blame but myself. I screwed up. Now, the truth of the matter is that this is a society with a pretty rigid class structure. And although there's a limited mobility in any part of the economy, from the poorest to the most successful financially, it's very limited. It's about 1% to 2% that can move in that direction over the course of many, many years. But the vast majority of people are going to find very, very little in the way of mobility from where they are to where they might want to be. And what we discovered is that it's a total lie to say that you're in that lower 80% of income earners or wealth holders because you didn't work hard enough. On the contrary, if you look at the bottom 20 to 30% of the population, they work just as hard, if not a lot harder, than anybody in the top 20%. And they have the same range of IQ as anybody in the top 20% of the earners and wealth holders. Where you are is not a function of your smarts, and it's not a function of how hard you worked. It's a function of often of what you were born into and what miraculous things opened up for you. Now, yeah, there are some people who have made it up and they are brought out and presented to us as, look, here's this African-American who's now on the Supreme Court or in the Senate. Here's this immigrant who came from an immigrant family and they are successful here. So that there are such people, they're presented to us as though this was the reality, whereas actually it's an extremely unrepresentative reality. And most people are not in there, and it's not their fault. There's a class structure here and an economic and political structure that makes it very, very difficult. Now, on top of that, because the daily experience in the world of work is one that makes you feel like you're surrounded by people who are looking out for number one, you come out of the work world. And by the way, we ask people, how do you feel about your work world? And they would say, it's lousy. I don't like this job. I don't like what I'm doing. So we'd say, okay, then why not change this system? And they'd say, well, I can't do that because everybody else is so selfish and looking out for number one that they'll never move. So we've said to them then, how did you know that? And say, well, that's what everybody says in the world of work. And that's how the whole world of work is structured. And yes, but the thing is that everybody is saying this about everybody else. So we'd come back and say, okay, let's talk about your friends. Pick your top 10 friends. Are they all selfish? And after thinking about it, they'd say, 9 out of 10 would say, no, they're not. It's just everyone else is selfish. In other words, people have come to believe this almost as a matter of faith because it is represented to them in the world of work that this is natural. And then they turn on the television and almost every sitcom is about somebody having power over somebody else, whether it's in economic terms or whether it's in political terms or whether it's in sexual conquest, whatever it is, it's all about who is top dog and who isn't, who's going to get more power over others and who's going to have less power. So over and over again, and this, by the way, this happens starting in childhood, not only from our parents who tell us, hey, you could become president of the United States if you work hard. And then the school system that is based on that, hey, if you study enough and you work hard here in this, you'll get any job you want. Not true. There are only a limited number of jobs that give people any opportunity to really use their intelligence and creativity. So when they get into the world, they already bring this with them, and they've come to believe that the only rational way to live is to advance their own interests without regard to the consequences for others. But this is a disaster, because that way, when you hold that belief, inevitably, you bring that into your family life. And pretty soon, families feel very insecure, because now, increasingly, people enter into marriages based on the notion that, oh, well, this person is going to satisfy more of my needs than anybody else. Now, what's the problem there? I'm not putting anybody down who thinks that way. I'm merely saying that when you have a society filled like that, more and more people find at some point in their life that their partner has encountered somebody whom they believe might satisfy yet more of their needs. So if the bottom line is maximizing your own self-interest, then you'd be irrational to stay in a relationship if there's another one that you could be in that would satisfy more of your needs. So as a result, you live in a society with someplace between 45 and 50% of marriages ending up in divorce. But it's not just those that end up in divorce, because most everybody, even those who don't end up in divorce, never are sure that their partner won't at some point in their life go for their own narrow self-interest without regard to the commitment to the other. So that makes everybody feel deeply insecure. Now, on top of that, you then have a deep hole in the heart of most people, because actually, most people want a world of work and a life in which somehow or other they are connecting to higher meaning and purpose for their life. Right now, the capitalist marketplace teaches them that the highest goal that you can have is to become more financially successful. But first of all, that's out of the question for about 80% of the population. And secondly, even for those who do make it there, they soon find out that having that money is not enough, that they need something else, higher meaning and purpose to their life that isn't judged by how much money they have or how much power they have, but by connecting to some higher meaning for their life. And that's where religion comes in, or other forms of spirituality and gives them a path to something that will give them real meaning and purpose. Now, the tragedy in American society is that many of those religious institutions are connected to reactionary politics. So you go into those institutions, and many of the people, at least in the right-wing churches, they embrace you and they welcome you. And they help with a major problem that leads so many people to alcoholism or drug abuse or other self-destructive paths for their life. The message that is given by the capitalist marketplace, as I said, is it's your own fault. And that makes so many people feel terrible about themselves that they turn to alcohol, they turn to drugs, they turn to a variety of behaviors that manage to momentarily drown the pain that they have when they ever confront the alleged truth that they've screwed up their own life. But it's not true. What's true is that you're living in a class-dominated society and a patriarchal society in which is structured to reward the few at the expense of the many. But in any event, they go to these churches and the churches say, you know, you shouldn't blame yourself. It's not your fault. And that is so strong a message that many of those people who go there feel like, this is what I was waiting for, a place where people could accept me and say that I'm not to blame for not being more successful in the society. But then the right-wing churches take another step and they say, the reason why it's not your fault is because it is the fault of, and this is a universal formula, that then they go to whoever is the demeaned other of their society and say, it's their fault that you're not having a fulfilling life. It's not your fault. It's these other people's fault. Well, in Europe, in the first half of the 20th century, who was that? That was the Jews. The Jews were blamed for everybody else's not having fulfillment in their work and fulfillment in their life. In the United States, it has always been Native Americans and African Americans who get blamed. But in the past 50 years, that has expanded dramatically so that now it also includes feminists, all people of color, refugees, liberals, progressives. It's endlessly expanding. You can add others to that, gays and lesbians, right? And so many other groups are the fault. They're only looking out for their own interests, whereas we in this church, we care about everybody's interests. Well, so, for a lot of people, particularly white people, that's such an important message that makes them feel they want to stay there. Sadly, we have a left in this country that doesn't understand how important it is to address this hunger for meaning and purpose to their lives.
That was Rabbi Michael Lerner talking with us in 2020. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the rest of that conversation. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.